Welcome to Mind the Gap.
Here's what we do. We will set up. This is tunnel vision.
From planet to planet.
And
solar system to solar system.
And
from galaxy to galaxy.
React.
We switch you to Earth.
Uncensored.
Copy, Skywatch, clear.
Another public service message from way out. We care about your world. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Mind the Gap with Jason Vass and
Gus Castanis.
Yes, that would be the two
of us.
That's
me.
Yep. Wishing all of our listeners a really good June and a great upcoming beginning of summer, which is this month. We open the show as usual with React by Jurassic 5. So as usual, we're going to leap into a bunch of art stuff, because that's the thrust of our show and seemingly where we want to go with it. And we always say that, and we're saying it again. So we begin this show with the passing of an important L.A. artist, performance art legend Chris Burden, who died at the beginning of May, May 10th, at 69. So I'm going to read a little bit on Chris Burden, because he's an important guy here in L.A. Performance artist and sculptor Chris Burden, who may remain best known for a performance in which he had himself shot in the arm, died today at his home, well, that was May 10th, in Topanga Canyon, California, at the age of 69. The cause was malignant melanoma, according to the artist's friend Paul Schimmel, as reported in the L.A. Times. Both L.A. and New York currently have sculptures by the artist on prominent display. Urban Light, 2008, his assemblage of street lamps, is on view outside the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, LACMA. And in Manhattan, two works adorn the facade of the new museum, Ghost Ship, 2005, in the shape of a boat, and Twin Quasi-Legal Skyscrapers, 2013, in the form of twin towers. The latter works addressed current events such as Hurricane Sandy and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and remain on view since a 2013-2014 retrospective there. Quote, Chris was an artistic giant, a mentor to so many, an influential teacher, a maverick who played by his own rules, a fearless risk taker, endlessly curious, and also rigorous and exacting, unquote. New museum director Lisa Phillips told ArtNet News via email, quote, it was a great honor to work with him so closely over the past several years to realize his biggest museum exhibition, including a monumental installation on the new museum facade that he hoped would alter the skyline of our neighborhood. It will remain on view for the next several months in tribute to Chris and his vision. Our thoughts go out to his wife and lifetime partner, Nancy Rubens, as well as to Katie and the entire team at the studio, who are really an extended family, unquote. Quote, few artists can claim a body of work as rich, varied, and influential as Chris Burden, LACMA director Michael Govan told ArtNet News via email. Quote, personally, it has been a privilege and pleasure to work with Chris on the installation of two monumental works at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, Urban Light and Metropolis 2, two artworks that have become destinations for visitors of all backgrounds. Chris has left his mark not only on the art world, but also on Los Angeles, his home since the late 1960s. Thanks to Urban Light, installed at LACMA's entrance and made from 202 historic LA street lamps, it stands as a testament to the lasting power of Chris Burden's talent, skill, and imagination, unquote. Due to Burden's willingness to endure physical suffering and even injury in his 1970s performances, those performances are still bracing. Burden had a friend shoot him in the arm, 1971, had himself confined for nearly a week in a locker, five-day locker piece, 1971, his master's project at the University of California, Irvine, had himself shocked, doorway to heaven, 1973, and had himself crucified on the roof of a car, transfixed, 1974. To create Through the Night Softly, 1973, he crawled across broken glass. The New Yorker magazine critic Peter Shishendal called Shoot both a classic and an atrocity. In response to the critic's question as to why he created such works, Burden told him, quote, "I wanted to be taken seriously as an artist," unquote. During the same period, he created ads for himself, which he aired on local television, toying with the distinction between art and entertainment, four TV ads, 1973-1977. Quote, "It felt that TV was basically a one-way street," the artist said in an interview for Mocha TV. "How could you get on TV? It finally dawned on me that the way you could get on TV was that you could buy the time, just like any other product. The programming is just fluff. The guts of TV was the ads," unquote. He found it a great feeling, he said, to have millions of homes receiving his message via television. When a producer pulled the video of him crawling over glass, volunteer lawyers intervened on his behalf. Quote, "It was a very powerful feeling to have the TV stations cowering when you called them up when you've only spent $900, he says, laughing in the interview. The ad rep who took that payment was fired, he said. In 1972, visitors to Burden's show at LA's Mizuno Gallery saw what appeared to be a crime scene with a body lying under a blanket on La Cienega Boulevard, surrounded by police flares. In fact, it was the artist himself, quote, "making a piece of sculpture," unquote, as he later put it. He was arrested for creating a false emergency. The jury in the case failed to reach a decision after 3 days of deliberation, and ultimately the judge dismissed the case. In a 1975 interview, Burden defined art as, quote, "a free spot in society where you can do anything," unquote. Since quitting performance in 1979, Burden worked as a sculptor, notably creating giant bridge-shaped constructions with Meccano and erector set parts. These works recalled childhood play taken to absurd extremes of scale. In other works, Burden turned his attention to state power structures and oppressive authority. His sculpture, LAPD Uniforms, made in the wake of the 1992 LA riots following the acquittal of the police officers who beat taxi driver Rodney King, consisted of drastically oversized police uniforms. I don't know if you ever saw that. Have you ever seen any of this guy's work? Oh my God, just really terrific.
No.
Just terrific. He filled the room with giant police uniforms hanging on hangers on the wall. Just sort of like a brilliant, chilling commentary. But his video work, the video where he shot, is an extraordinary piece. It can be seen.
I just don't understand why that's art. I mean, it's something. I mean, I guess people pretending to be shot in movies is art too, right?
I guess on some level, I mean, with blood, with ketchup and ink.
Sure.
But film is an art form. The actor in the film getting shot well, how well he takes the shot, is interesting. You'd have to see the video to sort of get your own reaction to what you might think of shoot.
Okay, I don't think I'm going to be doing that.
It's not so bad. I mean, he hired a guy. It's worth.
I detest violence when it's fake. Why would I like violence when it's real? Especially when it's pointless.
Well, people are transfixed by it. I mean, it's the rubbernecking aspect. You may say that I'm not doubting that you abhor violence and that it's difficult to see. In this instance, the guy shot him in the arm, so it wasn't as though it was a kill shot or anything like that. And when he hired the Vietnam War vet sharpshooter, the idea was to graze the arm. And when you see it, he really gets shot in the upper tricep. His reaction is powerful because initially it's sort of like you don't really notice it, and then you have this reaction where he's sort of like dizzy and discombobulated. It's just a powerful performance art. It can be powerful, and it was something that hadn't been necessarily done and filmed like that, where you see an artist doing something like that and using himself as the protagonist within it. It's interesting. Okay, so getting back to this. All the submarines of the United States of America in 1987, through hundreds of cardboard models, gave visual form to one aspect of Americans' military infrastructure. It should be noted that shoot took place during the Vietnam era after the Kent State shootings. Another work of Burden's took the form of a retort to Mya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. Burden had the names of 3 million Vietnamese who were killed in the war engraved on copper plates panels. That work belongs to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. It was only in 2013-2014 that Burden had his first New York Museum survey, Extreme Measures, at the new museum, organized by the museum's director, Lisa Phillips, along with several associate directors. The exhibition notably included a pyramid of gold bricks that was worth $4 million and was viewable by only one visitor at a time, and a giant installation depicting two cities at war, along with two sculptures on the museum's facade. He had previously not been treated to a U.S. respective exhibition since one organized by Paul Schimmel at the Newport Harbor Art Museum in 1988. He had a work included in the 48th Venice Biennale in 1996. 2008, Public Art Fund presented What My Dad Gave Me, one of his skyscraper sculptures at Rockefeller Center in New York. His work is featured in prominent museum collections as LACMA, Museum of Contemporary Art Los Angeles, the Whitney Museum of Modern Art, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Tate Gallery, London, Middelheim Museum, Antwerp, Belgium, and various museums throughout the world. He was born in 1946 in Boston, Massachusetts. He attended Pomona College and received his MFA from the University of California in 71. He's survived by his wife, the sculptor Nancy Rubens. So just rest in peace, Chris Burden. I think you did some fantastic work, and it's for all to see here in Los Angeles. If you go by LACMA, you'll certainly see his streetlight homage on Wilshire Boulevard for all to see. Moving right along, we're going to talk a little bit about this crazy world of auctions and all of these record-shattering events that have taken place in the last month. We do a monthly show, so we try and encapsulate the past month. So this is going to be about stuff that occurred in May. I don't know if you've heard of this, but the title of this article is $179 million Picasso sets stratospheric record at Christie's, $705.9 million sale they had. This is dated May 11th. Brian Boucher, ArtNet News. At Christie's, New York, Monday night, this was Monday, May 11th, painting by Picasso became the most expensive work of art ever sold at auction when it was picked up for $179.4 million. A Giacometti purchased as well at the same sale for $141 million became the priciest sculpture ever bought at auction. All of this took place in a mere 90 minutes. Christie's sale of Impressionist to Contemporary Art, looking forward to the past, tallied $705.9 million, well above a pre-sale estimate of $500 million. Every work but one found a buyer. The new owners are unknown, mostly winning their prizes anonymously via phone. I'm going to update that, though, because we know who bought the Picasso. It was the third highest total on any sale in the house's history, especially striking since there were just 35 items on offer, far fewer than its previously record-breaking sales. Quote, recognizable assets are very much in demand, New York dealer Daniela Luxemburg told ArtNet News on her way out of the sale room. Quote, an amazing success, amazing, said New York dealer Christoph van de Vee. The new highs were partly due to new collectors entering the art market. Every one of the works in the top 10 tonight was bid on by very new clients. Auctioneer Jussi Pikkelenon said at a post-sale news press conference, competing at the highest level were people who have been in the market only 5 or 6 years. Bidders hailed from 35 countries. Showing partly nude women in a harem, Picasso's La Femme d'Alger, version O, 1955, inspired an 11-minute bidding war, mostly between Christie's post-war and contemporary art specialist Loic Gauzer, who spearheaded the sale, and Brett Gorvy, head of post-war and contemporary art, who were the sole bidders beyond $150 million. Each was accepting bids via phone from unknown bidders. When the hammer came down, applause broke out, and New York dealer Tony Shafrazi shouted out congratulations to two of them from the sales floor. Quote, they worked hard for a Monday night, unquote, Shafrazi told ArtNet News after the sale. The Picasso was based on Eugene Delacroix's canvas of the same name, La Femme d'Alger, and is the last of the 15 of the series. Delacroix's painting, which hangs in the Louvre, was based on a visit to a harem in Algiers, then newly a French colony. Christie's had a direct financial interest in the painting, which was the subject of an 85-page catalog the house published to promote it. The painting, just under 5 feet wide, brought $31.9 million in Christie's in 1997 on an estimate of $10 to $12 million. So that means, Gus, that this painting, which sold in 1997 for $32 million, basically, just went for $180 million. Picasso's canvas beat out Francis Bacon's $142.4 million triptych, Three Studies of Lucian Freud, which sold at Christie's New York in November of 2013, becoming the most expensive auction trophy. Coming in at second for the night and setting a new record for the priciest sculpture at $141.7 million was Alberto Giacometti's Pointing Man, 1947, which surpassed the previous high for a sculpture, $104 million, achieved at Sotheby's London in 2010 with a work by the same artist. His Chariot went for over just $100 million at Sotheby's New York in November 2014, the only one of six versions hand-painted by the artist, and only of two not in museums, an early six-foot-tall work had remained in private hands since 1970. The Giacometti was one of the only top lots in the sale that was not guaranteed to sell ahead of time. Quote, they were flying without a net on that one, unquote, New York dealer Larry Gagosian said. We offered the seller a guarantee, Gorevsky told Artnet News, but he said, no, if it doesn't sell, I'll take the work back. He might have been a little upset that he actually sold it. The hyperactive sale marked the start of an uncommonly busy week of auctions of lots of stuff that we're going to talk about. The third highest sale of the night was Picasso's Buste de Femme, 1938, which brought $67.4 million, well above its $55 million estimate. It was also guaranteed to sell by the house and shows a bust of the artist Dora Maar against a bright red background. Estimated at $30 to $50 million, Mark Rothko's number 36, Black Stripe, 1958, fetched $40 million to come in fourth. It had been off the market since 1984 when the seller bought it from Zurich dealer Thomas Amann. The painting shows three of Rothko's trademark floating rectangles, black, red, orange, floating before a pale red ground. But I just want to get to one other thing. Nah, that's pretty much it. So, I mean, it's just an extraordinary day of $705 million in sales with just 35 pieces. I don't really know how this applies to anything else in the art world. It's just these extremely rarefied high-end things that seem to sell for just crazy money. Just
well, it actually makes sense because the last 20 years, money has gone to the top 1%, so they have all this money to put someplace, and you can only buy so many houses and so jet or whatever, and you have to start putting it into other things, and it makes sense to put it into art since it seems to be, at the high end of the thing, pretty much immune to inflation.
And keeps going up in value.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to put your money because, like, there's only one of these paintings. There's, you know, so it's worth 10 times more than it was before. Is that what it is?
Well, in 1997, not quite 20 years, 18 years past, it sold for $30 million. In 20 years, it went up $150 million. That's an enormous... So what's that? That's
that's a six times return, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. It went up five times.
Five times, so that's good return. I mean, but who knows?
Well, five threes are what?
15.
Yeah.
But if we bought a building in a certain area in 1995, and what is that building worth now? Could also be that. I mean, I don't know. It's the price of stuff that's really worth something that's gone up. It's the other stuff that seems to be somewhat stagnant.
Yeah, you bought a house 20 years ago. There's a lot of people who haven't seen that kind of appreciation.
Right.
But
you put your money in the bank 20 years ago, and you might have 5% more, 6% more.
Yeah, you didn't make just these huge leaps. So from that, I'm going to leap to another auction that they had, which brought in $658.5 million. So let's add that up. We have two auctions in the space of a few days by Christie's that one sold $658 million and one sold $705 million. So we've got over $1 billion was realized in 1 week by Christie's auction house, which is just astounding and astronomical. Okay, and tonight, this is again Artnet News, Brian Boucher, Wednesday, May 13th. In a night of frenzied selling, Christie's New York racked up $658.5 million from the world's wealthiest over a two and a quarter hour sale of post-war and contemporary art. on the same day as the VIP preview at the Freeze Art Fair on Randall's Island. The astronomical sale saw three works sell for north of $50 million, eight for upwards of $20 million, and 20 for better than $10 million. $50 million is the new normal, New York dealer Francis Betty of Richard Feigen and Company said after the sale. Mark Rothko's 8-foot tall abstract number 10, 1958, was the prize lot. The painting was guaranteed to sell. Off the market for nearly 30 years, the canvas hadn't been on public view since 1987. Features the artist's trademark floating rectangles of color, in this case deep reds, floating in front of a black background. Seven anonymous fund bidders slugged it out for nearly 6 minutes. Even Arte Povera, poor art, a post-war Italian movement that expressed scarcity, turned up very rich with the night's first offering, a Giovanni Anselmo sculpture estimated at up to $800,000, rising to eight times its high estimate to command $6.4 million, a record for the artist. That set the tone for a night of wild spending. Eight new auction records were set, including for Anselmo, Carol Dunham, $509,000, Lucian Freud, $56.2 million, Hans Hoffman, $6.3 million, Robert Ryman, $20.6 million, Sturtevant, $5 million, and Rudolf Stingel, $4.8 million. Robert Rauschenberg's 1968 Assemblage, Johansson's painting, also set a record when it sold for $18.6 million, beating his previous high by $4 million. That work was one of 20 lots on offer earlier in the evening that came from the collection of fabled New York dealer Elena Sonnebend, which New York dealer David Zwirner described to ArtNet News as, quote, beautiful material with a great provenance, unquote. That was a thing of beauty, New York dealer Kristen Tierney told ArtNet News. When you think auctions are about nothing but diamond dust, a bidding war over something rigorous and conceptual restores your faith in an intellectual elite. There are still some collectors out there who are the real deal. Several of the Sonnebend lots dramatically exceeded their estimates. Coming in second highest for the night was Andy Warhol's colored Mona Lisa, 1962, which went for $56.2 million to New York mega dealer Larry Gagosian, bidding from the sales floor against only a single other bidder after just a two-minute contest. It was created the year after Leonardo da Vinci's iconic painting made a tour of the United States. London dealer Pilar Ordovas snagged the night's third priciest lot, Lucian Freud's, benefits supervisor resting, 1994, for $56.2 million. She was bidding from the sales floor against several Christie staffers, bidding for clients by phone over a five-minute contest. Ordovas was formerly the deputy chairman of postwar and contemporary art at Christie's Europe, estimated at up to $50 million. The canvas shows the artist's friend Sue Tilley, a London government worker, naked and reclining on Freud's couch, her head thrown back. Quote, it's a pretty incredible painting and lusciously painted, city art advisor Suzanne Gregory said. Francis Bacon's portrait of Henriette Maurras, 1963, commanded $47.8 million to become the fourth priciest lot of the night. It went to the houses. Brett Gorvey, who was bidding on behalf of a client by phone after a contest of only just 1 minute. A 5.5-foot tall canvas shows Bacon's subject sprawled on a bed, her spread legs facing the viewer in a luridly hued purple and crimson room. The seller picked it up at Christie's London in 2012 for $33.5 million, so it increased in value by nearly half in just 3 years. Gagosian, bidding from the sales floor, bought an 8-foot-wide untitled Cy Twombly canvas slathered in house paint with drawing in crayon and pencil, which was the night's top estimated lot at $55 million. Despite falling short of that dramatic figure, it came in fifth highest for the night at $42.7 million, guaranteed to sell. The painting had been off the market and out of the public view since it was bought from Gagosian in 1989. That painting was only on the block for a minute, like the brief contest over the bacon. Zwirner blamed the limited bidding on those lots to the high guarantee the house had made on the canvases. Quote, when you start off so high, he said, it makes it hard for others to jump in. The Twombly canvas comes from a group of paintings known as the Bolsena works, named for the Italian lake on whose shores the artist painted them. After his 1964 show at Leo Castelli's gallery, which was not well received, according to the sale catalog, Twombly said he was, quote, the happiest painter around because, quote, for a couple of years, no one gave a damn what I did. New York dealer Christoph van de Vee went away disappointed, having bid on a Jean-Michel Basquiat painting, The Field Next to the Other Road, but failing to get it. Tonight, I bid $33 million. When I moved to New York in 1993, it came up for auction at Sotheby's. It was estimated at $125,000 to $175,000, but failed to sell. They told me afterward that if I offered $75,000, I could get it. I thought about it over the weekend, but on Monday I told them I didn't have the money. That was in 1993. So, he said, I failed twice. Extraordinary that he could have gotten it for $75,000 in 93 and this year bid $33 million and was unable to get it. So we really have just an extraordinary series of sales that took place in 1 week in May of this year, where Christie's brought in $705 million and then $658 million for a grand total of $1.3 billion. And
what's Christie's cut on that?
Christie's makes, they make smaller amounts on these bigger ticket items.
I hope so.
On a general sale, they get from the consigner, a normal consigned piece from Christie's is between 20 and 25%, and from the buyer, 20 or 25%. They make 50%. Now, in these kind of deals, Gus, what they do is they probably offer somewhere between 6 and 10% to the consigner. And then from the buyer, they're probably going to get 10, 15%. So they're making.
Oh, so it's like when you buy a house, you pay over the top.
Yeah, they're probably making somewhere between 15 and 20% on those sales. But because they guarantee them and they prepay, it's unknown exactly how much money they're really making on these. You figure at least 10%. So if they made a $700 million sale, maybe they made $70 million.
Okay, I have a question for you. How much corruption is there in the art world as opposed to the soccer world, what we've learned lately about FIFA?
Yeah.
I mean, is this stuff rigged?
Well,
there's a lot of people who have a lot to gain from artwork going up in price, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as FIFA, where you see bribes being offered, and with
more sophisticated people bribing people, perhaps.
Well, listen to this. I'm going to share this little bit of news, and then we're going to talk more about FIFA and Sepp Blatter and everything that went on there. Okay, did Vladimir Putin bribe a FIFA executive with a Picasso painting?
I did not. You know, you had that.
Yes, I had that. You know, I know you didn't, that's why synchronistically that was a great segue by you, Gus. You must have sneaked a peek at my papers.
Honestly,
here.
We had no pre-show meeting on this one.
Unfortunately, we should have more pre-show meetings. All right, listen to this: the world of international soccer was rocked Wednesday morning when seven officials from its governing body, FIFA, were arrested and many more indicted by U.S. and Swiss authorities in Zurich on charges of racketeering, fraud, and money laundering as part of an investigation the U.S. Justice Department has declared has only just begun. But what does this have to do with art, you may ask? It's alleged that soccer authorities systematically took personal bribes, some $150 million worth, according to the New York Times, to sway their decision-making about things like who would get to televise the games, who would oversee the worldwide soccer organization, and who would get to host World Cups. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin was accused this past December by England's 2018 World Cup bid committee of having bribed Michael Platini, the president of the Union of European Football Associations, UEFA, and FIFA executive committee member with a painting by Pablo Picasso in exchange for voting for Russia to stage the next World Cup, which they did in fact get, if you know, in 2018.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah. The painting was reportedly taken out from the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Putin just sent some guys in, said, that Picasso over there, take it off the wall. We need it. They took it off the wall, and it was given as a bribe. And these Picassos ain't cheap. They're worth tens.
Well, we know.
We were just discussing. Yeah, one just sold for $180.
We actually have that data right here.
Yes, we have it. Exactly. According to a report in the Sunday Times, which is a British paper, the committee got its information about the Russian bid, quote, from a network of British embassies and private intelligence firms staffed by former M16 officers, and was disclosed in a dossier that Parliament published. Perhaps it's because the Russian president has a greater vested interest in Russia hosting the 2018 World Cup than previously thought. Platini, of course, denied the accusations at the time, telling CNN, quote, allegations in the Sunday Times relating to my actions in the 2018 and 2022 bidding processes are total fabrications, unquote. Platini was in the news yesterday for his request that FIFA President Sepp Blatter step down in the wake of the corruption claims. Putin is also alleged to have bribed Belgian FIFA official Michel de Hooghe with a landscape painting. The canvas by an unnamed artist was reportedly given to him wrapped in a paper bag by Russian 2018 World Cup committee member and former FIFA vice president Vyacheslav Koloskov. Bear with me and my pronunciation. These are some tricky names. De Hooghe denied voting for Russia in the 2018 World Cup bidding and called the painting, quote, absolutely ugly, which means that he was given the painting. I mean, look, he's denying the bribe, but then suddenly the painting was ugly.
Well, maybe he's seen it.
Yeah. Following the report, the Russian bid committee released a statement insisting, quote, Russia 2018 categorically rejects all of the allegations made in the Sunday Times today as totally unfounded speculation. So I would think that there's not quite as much corruption in the auction world, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a lot of behind the doors kind of pat pat, shake shake, deal deal on a lot of these things for these big monies. And I think that's why we have to guess that Sotheby's and Christie's make less than 10% on these, because they're so tightly controlled.
All the more reason that I would think that there's corruption, because this is the corruption that's going on with FIFA is just so out of control and so apparent and visual. I mean, it took the DOJ like a few months. They figured this stuff out so quickly because they're not trying to hide it.
Well, they got some people to roll. They got that major American guy. They squeezed him really hard, and he rolled on everyone. And now that Seth Blatter has resigned.
Is that the guy that has the cat, the Trump Tower apartment for
his
cat?
Yes, that's right. He is the Trump Tower multi-bedroom apartment for the cat. Yeah, that's
a great cat.
That's a special feline. I mean, and how insufferable this be? I have my own apartment at Trump Plaza. What could you possibly offer me? You know, catnip? What, are you crazy?
Yeah.
But think about it. Sepp Blatter, now that we sort of think, did he clearly was approached and they say we got the goods and now he's resigned and he's going to roll on everyone else? Because for him to resign so quickly upon being reelected president indicates that they must have approached him and said we got the goods.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the whole thing about it is that it's they don't tell anybody what people are paid. So, I mean, look at Goodell, who we know how much he's paid. He's making $30 to $40 million a year. I mean, if you're in charge of FIFA and you're making that much money, you could probably legally pay yourself $100 million a year, and then that's fine. Why do you need to take bribes when you're making that much kind of money?
Well, that's why it's extraordinary that you would, right, his whole thing of each country gets the same vote and getting all those little islands, all those tiny municipalities, you have the same votes as France or Germany or the United States.
It's kind of like our Congress, isn't it?
Well, yeah, especially when you have lots of redistricting involved in
the gerrymandering. We go into this as a whole different discussion.
Yeah, it is. But good segue to FIFA and the auction world. It's unknown to me. There's been no DOJ investigation of the auctions. It's unknown what information could be revealed by a thorough investigation of the auction world. But they're publicly traded companies. They're more transparent than FIFA. FIFA, as you know, as you clearly stated, none of their information is disclosed, none of their salaries. It's very, very hidden. And so virtually no information is known about them.
Well, I mean, at that high level, who knows what's going on? But certainly when you look at what was going on in 2007 when the economy melted down, there was a lot of that sort of wink, wink, you know, nod, nod stuff going on in these illegal deals that where people, you know, lost other people's money in massive amounts. I'm just not surprised by anything that people will do for money.
Let us not be surprised for the grasp of power and money being anything goes. Just literally anything goes. Let's move to another art story, which is the Pablo Picasso canvas that set a record on May 11th at Christie's for the most expensive work ever sold at auction at $179.4 million may have gone to a buyer from Qatar. Unnamed art world sources are telling the New York Post that the buyer of Femme d'Alger, version O, 1955, was billionaire former Qatar Prime Minister Hamad bin Jasmin bin Jabar Al Thani. Buyers at auctions typically maintain their anonymity by bidding via phone. The Picasso was won by an anonymous telephone bidder. One source tells the Post that the painting almost certainly would not go on display in Qatar because of nudity. Now, you have to look at that photo. Look, there's the painting.
Okay.
So, no, it's upside down.
Well, it's...
Okay. Okay. So now it's a small...
Cubism, come on.
Yeah, it's cubism. I'm saying there's no specific form of nudity there. Right. You're turning it every which way. You're looking for nudity. It's hard to see. You can see.
I'm getting a little aroused. But I'm looking at the watch ad right next to it. Maybe that's...
Okay, yeah. Do not look at the Patek Philippe from Geneva. Look at the painting. Okay, so you see this painting is in no way erotic at all. It's just crazy. So... funnily enough, the painting was also censored by a Fox News affiliate, which blurred out the breasts when it reported on the painting's sale and record-breaking price. But Al Thani doesn't lack for places to display the painting. The London Independent reported in 2013 in an article headlined, "Meet the Man Who Bought London," that Al Thani owned, quote, some of the capital's most prestigious addresses, unquote. The Post indicates that the former sheik also bought real estate tycoon Abby Rosen's East Side 71st Street mansion for some $47 million in 2012. So he's got places to put this painting. And it's not the country of Qatar, but this individual from Qatar. The Qatar Museum's authority also reportedly the buyer of a Paul Gauguin painting, which we talked about a few months ago, that sold earlier this year for $300 million. So that's the private sale record. $300 million for a painting by Paul Gauguin was bought by Qatar earlier this year, a few months ago. And now a ex-public official has bought the Picasso for $180 million. And they bought some other art, too. So this year alone, two or three, four pieces of art, they've spent $1 billion on
art.
Well,
how much did they spend to get that World Cup?
That's the thing. Okay, we're drawing in
that
Qatar.
Was $300 million, wasn't it?
Well, at least in bribes, probably. They say at least $150 million.
The whole thing is only worth like $500 million. So it's like a major portion of it is being spent on bribes.
You mean the World Cup and its assorted revenues is worth about $500 million. Did you hear about the workers associated with building the stadiums? Did you hear this?
Yeah, but, you know, people
They said that 1,400 workers have died.
And this could go up to 5,000.
Right. Potentially could be 5,000 people dying in the process of building the stadiums. What would be the energetic sense? What would you feel if you were a player going to Qatar, knowing that 5,000 people died making the stadiums? 5,000, how would you feel?
5,000 people that aren't from Qatar.
Correct.
5,000
workers brought in.
Workers from Indonesia and from India and who are just a sad story. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I don't see how in this day and age you could get away with that kind of stuff.
Right. So you have 14...
Especially with sponsors. That's the whole idea.
Right.
I mean,
that's
what
why...
in this country with Ray Rice.
Well, that's why they set Sepp Blatter stepped down, because Visa and Coca-Cola and some of these others stepped up and finally said, this is not right. These endless... Okay, now that the Justice Department has done this, it has raised our profile in the world. I saw today the French Open was being played, and there's a new head of tennis, International Tennis Federation, is stepping down. And for the first time, I mean, there's only in the 105-year history of the tennis federation, there's only been four Americans to head it, and not since the 70s. So they're saying that this movement by the Department of Justice and our actions against FIFA has galvanized the world to a sense that the U.S. is really honest, above board, transparent, and we potentially could now be leading the tennis federation. I don't see one of our members of FIFA becoming the head of FIFA.
Well, it's because, you know, first of all, we have no American tennis players who are, other than Serena Williams, who are worth their salt. And second of all, look how small football or soccer really is in America still.
Well, in comparison. But yes, I think there was an Italian heading the International Tennis Federation. It's not like they have any big players. So it's not so much your country...
Have you ever met an Italian that doesn't talk about the blue? That's everything to them.
No. Not I'm saying in tennis though.
Oh,
you say it's because they had a tennis. The head of the tennis federation was an Italian, and there were no big tennis players. I mean, really, Italian tennis players. There's some good ones, but there's not.
Yeah, but
there's no number one.
Tennis has kind of dropped off the table in America.
It's kind of dropped off the table in lots of places too. Let me finish this article quickly about this though. Is this okay? So the Guitar Museum's authority is also reportedly the buyer of a Paul Gauguin painting that sold earlier this year for $300 million in a private sale held by a former Sotheby's executive, which would make it the highest recorded price ever paid for a piece of art. The Guitari Royals are known for deep-pocketed arts patronage, having also reportedly laid out $250 million for Cézanne's The Card Players in 2012, at the time the highest reported price ever paid for a piece of art. ArtNet was blown away by a mammoth Richard Serra land art installation the Emirate commissioned this year. Did you see that? You know who Richard Serra is, do you?
No.
He makes giant steel sculptures. They're thin steel pieces. There was one in New York. There's several in L.A. They weigh tons. They're usually about 10 to 15 feet high, and they're thin. They're only about a couple of inches thick, but they're like ribbons of steel. They're fantastic. In my opinion, he's an extraordinary artist. And I saw the pictures of this. They put these giant steel, it's sort of like 2001, that sort of
obelisk. It's not an obelisk.
It's sort of like a rectangle of sort of black hole-ish. It's sort of like it appears. This is what his art is like. It's just like it's just like they're panels, but they're giant. They weigh a lot, and they are no means of support. They just sit on the ground because they weigh tons. They can't move. If the thing ever fell over, it'd kill somebody. It would kill whoever it was near it. Anyway, I saw photos of this piece in the desert. Incredible. It's just like a vision in the desert of these panels.
Which desert?
It's in Qatar. This is something the Qataris just...
Cool.
Yeah, exactly, since we're talking about them. All right, let's just finish this. Al Thani was prime minister from 2007 to 2013. He had been foreign minister since 1992 and remained in that position while also serving as prime minister. He's also head of the Qatari Investment Authority, which invests the oil-rich nation's money in companies like Volkswagen, Porsche, and the French soccer team Paris Saint-Germain. So I just wanted to share that he was reportedly the buyer of the $180 million Picasso. I've got a couple of other articles here about how this record-shattering Picasso sale heralds the beginning of the end for the current art market boom, and several articles along those lines about how this is just the beginning of the end, and it's using statistics based on when the Japanese paid $80 million for that Van Gogh, that paper tycoon in Japan, and how the entire world slightly changed afterwards. And still for inflation, if they factor in inflation and other numbers, that Van Gogh purchase still is over about $145 million, and it really caused the bankruptcy of many Japanese firms, and it ended up with the banks in Japan having somewhat like thousands of pieces of art, which they are still holding in now, saying a value of $3 billion from all of that craziness. I could go into all of that. I may, but I just want to jump to something else because that's just the way I feel. Oh, how long have we been doing this?
43
minutes. You know, let's take a break.
I think we listen to some music?
Yeah, let's listen to some music.
All right, let's take a break. We'll play something and we'll be right back. Or maybe you should have said that.
Change my hand.
You're listening to Mind the Gap with Gus Castanis and Jason Vass, and that was Goldfrapp, You Never Know.
You Never Know, with a U.
So continuing on with our sort of craziness, oh, here's something that I thought would catch your eye. Sotheby's puts a $100 million price tag on Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch.
Does that come with the merry-go-round?
Neverland Ranch, the infamous 2,700-acre estate in California that once belonged to the late pop star Michael Jackson, is up for sale by Sotheby's International Realty in Hilton Highland. According to the Wall Street Journal, the estate, once called Sycamore Valley Ranch, is now much more like it was before Jackson installed the amusement park rides and zoo that Neverland is famous for, but the swimming pool, basketball, and tennis courts, movie theater, and once functional firehouse remain in memoriam of Jackson's utopian home.
Firehouse?
Yeah, he wanted a firehouse. 2780, if there was a fire, he wanted them immediately on the spot. There was no waiting.
Oh, firehouse.
Yeah, firehouse. Yeah.
I thought it was something I didn't understand.
Well, yeah, there may have been some other elements to that, too. You'll just let your imagination go on that. He really liked firemen and sweaty boots. The ranch, which Jackson bought for $19.5 million in 1987, is on the market for $100 million, a pretty good return for Colony Capital, the investment firm that helped Jackson pay for the property when he struggled to maintain the cost. The pop star lived at Neverland for over 15 years, during which time he worked on his 1991 album Dangerous, in between entertaining guests from high-profile investors to terminally ill children. Despite the once public nature of the estate come amusement park, the listing agents are careful to keep viewings to a minimum. All potential buyers must meet, quote, extensive pre-qualification, unquote, before viewing the property. So I guess we're not rushing off to see that. I'm not sure we could cut the mustard.
No. I'm not sure I really would want to go.
Well, you never know. I mean, it could be of interest. Where the heck am I?
I don't know. I think it's kind of roadkill, isn't it?
It really is.
This is the room. This is the room where they all did this, and this is the room where they did that. And this is where the Gross parents waited while they were hoping that he was molesting their children so they could make money off of him.
The 20 mil is what he paid. Gross. Yeah, yeah. Oh, here's another one. This is a really interesting.
That makes people look kind of nice.
Okay, you know there's that bridge in Paris where people put locks?
Yes, I heard about this.
You did hear about this.
They're taking the locks away. My friend, Johnny Aragon, was there. He was there with his fiance. He's losing his lock.
I mean, is there love
He's out
doomed?
Of lock.
Is there love doomed? Locked out?
Locked out. He's out of lock.
So I'll read briefly this. It's a bad day to be a lover. Paris city officials have begun the process of removing the hundreds of thousands of padlocks known as love locks that began to spring up on the side of the Pont d'Arc bridge half a decade ago. It's become a tradition for tourists and locals alike to fasten a padlock with their initials and those of a lover to the bridge as a symbol of eternity, tossing the key into the river Seine below. Unfortunately, while many of the relationships inevitably dissolve, the locks do not, and they have weighed heavily on the bridge. Despite the relative flimsiness of the locks, most were purchased for no more than a few dollars. Collectively, they weighed an estimated 45 tons.
45 tons of locks.
45 tons.
If you were Jewish, that could be quite exciting.
Yes, I'll
different
have...
Different type of lock.
Different type of locks. 90,000 pounds. There was constant concern that the bridge's panels, with their delicate ironwork, would give way under the weight of the locks and come crashing down on the boats below. Last year, part of the rail did collapse, though luckily no one was injured. On Monday, city workers equipped with a crane and wheeled dollies began tearing down the wire panels bearing love locks. The city will temporarily replace the wire siding with panels designed by local street artists. Those panels will eventually be replaced with plexiglass that will allow pedestrians to once again gaze upon the Seine, a view that was blocked by the wall of locks. When the locks first began to appear 5 years ago, they were initially welcomed. Quote, they could be seen as rather pleasant, Bruno Julliard, the deputy mayor of culture, told the New York Times. But as years passed, they took on such proportions that they were no longer acceptable for the cultural heritage. The locks that were affixed to the panels are to be kept in a city warehouse until officials decide their fate. They might be melted down or they may be donated to charity. There is no plan at present to retrieve the thousands of keys languishing at the bottom of the set.
That would be just a wonderful donation. It's like, here's a bunch of useless locks. Oh, great. Do you have any food?
On bridge panels. It's art. Just put it in a museum. Just put it in a gallery and sell it to the highest bidder.
Put it on auction.
Juilliard still wants tourists to see Paris, quote, as the capital of love, the capital of romance. That is, as long as they find other less destructive ways to express their passion. And, by the by, the BBC is a video of city workers removing and wheeling away the lock-laden panels, just in case reading about it isn't bummer enough.
Cool.
Yeah. So leave it to the BBC to do that.
I like the way they throw into there that many of these relationships are failed. It's like,
but these locks do not.
Did you do research on that? How did that research go about?
We're assuming that's the case. Yeah. How many relationships actually?
Maybe if they made a rule when it didn't last, you had to come back and take the lock out. You had to go and get the
key.
You
have to be honest about it. Show up.
You got to get the key.
Did you throw the key
Bummer, in? Man.
Hey, I threw the key in. That means the love lasts forever. We don't have a replacement key.
Well,
yeah, so.
You know, they're not all Catholics like they are in France because Catholics aren't allowed to get divorced.
Here's a classic article. George Baselitz, I'm sure you've heard of him. He's a painter, German painter. He makes disgraceful sexist remarks on women painters again. The German star artist George Baselitz has come under fire for making outrageously unabashed sexist remarks in an interview with The Guardian. The notoriously outspoken artist, you're going to like this article, was talking about his new exhibition at the pop-up White Cube Gallery at the Glyndebourne Opera Festival when the conversation turned to the subject of female artists. Quote, "The market doesn't lie," he explained to The Guardian's Kate Connolly. "Even though the painting classes in art academies are more than 90% made up of women, it's a fact that very few of them succeed. It's nothing to do with education or chances or male gallery owners. It's to do with something else. And it's not my job to answer why it's so." This is just extraordinary, this guy. I mean, you know, do you have more than a brain synapse cell? But Baselitz didn't stop there. Quote, "It doesn't just apply to painting either, but also music," he offered. When Connolly pressed him to elaborate, he added, "If women are ambitious enough to succeed, they can do so. Thank you very much. But up until now, they have failed to prove that they want to. Normally, women sell themselves well, but not as painters."
That's the oldest profession.
If Baselitz's opinion on female artists...
That's what he was
referring to. I don't think he was. He was just saying that in the way that we sell ourselves every day. If Baselitz's opinion on female artists sounds familiar, it's because he made nearly identical comments in an interview with the German magazine Der Spiegel in 2013. At the time, he insisted, quote, "Women don't paint very well. It's a fact." He backed up his claim by saying that women don't pass, quote, "the market test or the value test." It is undeniably true that male artists have traditionally performed better at auction than female artists. The auction record for a work by a male artist, which we just talked about earlier in the show, is $179 million. And the auction record for a female artist set by Georgia O'Keeffe stands at $45 million, which we talked about earlier this year.
Yes.
But unfortunately, Baselitz fails to consider societal factors such as the gender wage gap and gender stereotypes when making his comments, which sadly reinforce the art world's male bias. Applying the logic that higher prices indicate that men are better artists than women is deeply flawed, as is the logic that the quality of art is determined by its price. This is just another completely idiotic response by a male artist, and just extraordinary. Where are we?
We got 4 minutes.
We have 4 minutes. Okay, let's end with this Emma Sulkowitz piece. Now, earlier in this year, remember I talked about the Colombian graduate who carried the mattress around as this art statement?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, she carries the mattress to Columbia graduation, defying the administration. All right, Emma Sulkowitz, who contributed to a national conversation about rape on college campuses with a piece of performance art, brought her trademark mattress to the graduation ceremony at New York's Columbia University today, despite an emailed ban on large objects, which was clearly only being applied to her. Who else is bringing a large object other than themselves? Sulkowitz has garnered widespread attention since September 2014 for her senior thesis project, Mattress Performance Carry That Weight. She began the performance after the university refused to expel a classmate whom she accuses of raping her, vowing to carry a twin mattress, the sort of which is the assault of which the assault allegedly took place everywhere she went on campus until they left the school or graduated. Today, she was spotted hauling the mattress to her graduation ceremony with the help of other students. Images of Silkowitz and her classmates wearing blue cap and gown have appeared on social media. Silkowitz had as much as promised to bring the mattress to graduation. A conversation with the New York Times art critic Roberta Smith at the Brooklyn Museum in December. When asked how the project might conclude, she speculated about dropping the mattress at the feet of Columbia President Lee Bollinger at graduation to rousing applause. "I guess that's what I have to do now," Silkowitz said. Her alleged assailant is currently suing Columbia, blah, blah, blah. Silkowitz appeared sans mattress at the State of Union address earlier this year as a guest of U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, but chose to bring it to graduation despite an invitation email to the graduates, quote, "should not bring into the ceremony area large objects which could interfere with the proceedings or create discomfort to others in close, crowded spaces shared by thousands of people," read the email, which was reportedly not sent to previous graduating classes. So this was just specifically really earmarked for her. According to Armas, who tweeted from the event, four students aided Silkowitz in carrying the mattress across the stage. Bollinger, who shook hands with other graduates as they crossed the stage, reportedly turned away from Silkowitz, who attempted to lean over the mattress and catch his eye. She then kept walking, struggling with her free hand. "I even tried to smile at him or look him in the eye, but he completely turned away," she told the New York Times. "So that was surprising because I thought he was supposed to shake all of the students' hands when they graduated." Several sources have noted that she received lots of applause from the crowd. Well, there you have it. That's our show for June.
What's lots of applause?
Lots of applause is probably a scattering of applause, okay, versus none. I mean, who knows? It's, you know, just someone's opinion. But here we are.
Well, I just wonder what the fate of that mattress is in the future.
It's probably going to be up at Christie's or Sotheby's for a huge amount of money in an auction to be soon.
Hopefully not approaching Georgia O'Keeffe's.
$45 million? No, it won't be approaching that. Well, we're coming down to our last few seconds. Gus, any shout-outs, any wishes to...
Be good.
Shout-out to congratulations to Deborah Brown on your piece being accepted by the Royal Academy, which is on view now through July in London. Fantastic, very good, amazing. Congratulations.
Woohoo. We're going to listen to some music on the way out.
Yeah.
So I've written and it's hard to say. Pink moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink moon gonna get you. It's a pink moon. Pink, 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 pink. It's a pink moon. So I've written and it's hard to say. Pink moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink moon gonna get you. It's a pink moon. Ping, 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 ping. It's a pink moon. Ping, 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 ping. It's a pink moon.